You can claim the mountain of moral superiority and be there all alone. But understand, you will be there alone.
My favorite pillow guy.
He's throwing pillows out of crowds and getting sued for it.
It's the Festivus days of political parties. I got grievances with everyone, and you're all going to hear it. I agree with you wholeheartedly, Kurt. That is immediately disqualifying. I do not care. We grew up in the 9/11 generation. I was in eighth grade when 9/11 happened. I remember it vividly. That for me is a bridge too far.
So what's going on? What are we talking about? Party animals.
What say you? Because this cycle, I think more than most, we have seen outside money play big roles in primaries, and not outside money, but outside opponent money, where the other side is propping up a potential candidate. It's a tried and true tactic in politics, but what do you make of it, Kurt? What do you think of all of this outside money? What say you?
Okay, like on one hand, the spirit of it is disingenuous, right? Like if you are a Democrat running an ad because you want a certain type of Republican to be your opponent, it's like you're kind of rigging the game a little bit there. And vice versa, if you're a Republican, you're like, oh, wouldn't it be great if the crazy socialist won? So let's help prop up the crazy socialist because we can beat them in November much easier. It's like you're kind of playing God a little bit. And as we've seen in the past, that could backfire on you big time. I think tactically, there's a part of it that has always believed, like, if you spend money elevating someone, no matter who they are, you are helping them, whether you like, and maybe that's by design, but it also makes it harder to tear them down later on, I feel like. Because I just think playing God and meddling in other people's primaries is against the spirit of what our system is supposed to be. And so I'm not a fan of it, but it's also the way the game is played, and it can be incredibly effective.
The one point I would push back on there is, you know, how this plays into the primaries, because in a state like Wisconsin, it's an open primary. You can register day of and you can take a ballot. You can register to vote day of and take a ballot for whichever. It is a non-party primary, right? So you can walk in and say, I want the Democrat ballot. I want the Republican ballot. You don't have to be registered to those parties. So in that instance, it doesn't necessarily work that the idea is that we're being disingenuous to the process, because some of these are open primaries and people can vote. You know, Republicans, I remember, especially in like the 2011 Wisconsin era, where Republicans would vote in Dem primaries because they knew who was winning their race and they could have a play in this. Whether or not it's ads, and I think that maybe people don't realize, maybe it's ads, it's lit, it's something else. Voters do it too. Voters do that in states where they will vote in a primary if they can for the opposing party to try and give themselves the upper hand. I think tactically, it's not the prettiest tactic, but it certainly works. I mean, if the Republican Governors Association is putting $3 million in to prop up Francesca Hong, it must be because they know they can spend another $3 million on the other side of this, pushing her negatives with whatever oppo they have, opposition research, to hit her in the long run and take her out. They must see it internally.
Right. I guess I wish there was a way that we could reform the system slightly so that instead at the end of ads, at the beginning of ads, it was just made very clear. This is the Republican Governors Association ad on behalf of Francesca Hong. And just like provide that context before you watch the ad rather than at the end paid for by RGA. Like, you know, I just wish we had a system that provided more context up front than the way that it's done now. But again, like, hey, don't hate the player, hate the game. Like, it is what it is. People, like, my advice to Democrats, like, it would be like, hey, be better at it. Like, they're going to do it to us. So do it to them and be better at it. Cause this is where the left really, in my opinion, screws up. They oftentimes are the ones who like bitch and complain about when the, you know, like if the DCCC tries to like, you know, play a role in a primary or prop up what they would say is a crazy right wing candidate because it's easier to win in November. And there are those on the left who then like get really upset about that, whine about it, attack. And it's like, you know what? We got to play in the same game that everyone else is playing or we're never going to win.
That's right. You got to play by the rules that exist, even if you don't like them, right? Winners make policy, losers go home. And if you can play in it, you know, Democrats, that's why you have these party apparatuses, is because they are able to more largely fundraise, set up a national organization to bring money and resources into play in races, whether it's the primary in favor of an opposing candidate and trying to muck the waters up there or to push their own message. I think that listen, advertising, should we put the disclaimer at the front? Meh, no. No way. No way.
You spoke like the a plot true political consultant. Oh, let me ask you this. Yeah. Is there a difference between when it's like the RGA, like an established entity of the party, like does this versus like a random clean energy group that maybe no one has ever heard of that wants to, you know, throw a big money in a primary and boost an opponent and play in that way? Like, is there a difference to you?
Not necessarily, no, because outside money and outside organizations, they can play in all the primaries they want. And if they're doing it for an opposition or to, you know, for somebody else in the primary because they think that person's more beautiful. I mean, the Andy Ogles example is the good one, right? Where money mm-hmm. came in to support his opponent in the primary, but that's a safe Republican seat. And that was a clean energy initiative, but they did it because they thought they'd have a better shot with the other Republican in the seat mm-hmm. versus, listen, I think money coming into politics, whether it's outside groups or political entities, is how the system works. I've got no problem with it, because if you can have a billionaire put an extra $2 million into a race to help move it, that's the name of the game. I'm much more of the mindset that we got to play the game the way it exists instead of complaining about it. Because yeah, Democrats might not like super PACs, they might not like dark money, they might not like it, but dang, doesn't it help them along the way? And dang, don't they win races and get a lot of coverage from the people like George Soros, from these other billionaire entities? You can complain, but it's,
I mean, they
the name
complain
of the game.
because the ironic thing for Democrats here is, since Citizens United passed, 70% of billionaire contributions have gone to Republican-aligned candidates, not Democrats. Like, I always hear the George Soros thing. I think George Soros spent an exorbitant amount of money in politics over the years. I'm not saying he hasn't. But in totality, he spent about $120 million. Elon Musk beat that in one cycle last year single-handedly. I wish, again, this is a wish, not reality. I wish we had a system where it was like, if you aren't housed in the district or state that you're running an ad in, you don't get to put an ad there. Like, that to me would make it way more reasonable. I don't have a problem when state-aligned groups want to participate in an election, or a district-aligned group if it's congressional. I hate it when it's outside your state and there's money coming from all over the place. I think in the governor's race in Tennessee, it's like 70% of Marsha Blackburn's contributions have come from outside the state of Tennessee. Yeah, she's running for governor of Tennessee. It's like, that just doesn't sit well with me.
That happens a lot, though, in races. That happens a lot, though, in races.
I know, but I think it shouldn't.
Yeah,
it should.
I think, you know, that's the thing, though. I'm just a bloodthirsty monster. I want to win. So if there's outside money coming into a race,
operative, Aaron. Man, look at that.
Listen,
see?
Helpful dollars are helpful dollars. We got to play the game. And Bernie Sanders is out there saying that Democrats shouldn't take any super PAC money, get any super PAC support. And I don't know. Listen, like, I'm not one to give Dems advice, but if you guys want to Jeff Gillooly, Tanya Harding, tire iron yourself in the knees instead of playing the game by the way the rules are written, then, like, all right, take less money, have less opportunity to get your message out there when we're watching $28 million be reserved in Michigan by the Republicans and $100 million yeah. by Republicans in Georgia, right? Like, you guys don't want to play with the big dollar boys. Good luck.
Listen, you can, I would tell Democrats this, like, you can claim the mountain of moral superiority and be there all alone, but understand you will be there alone. You also have a lot of time to ruminate about it because you're not going to win. Like, you cannot win in the modern day election world that we live in by announcing that we are going to spot the other guys $30 million to start the race. Like, that's just like, no, that's not a winning recipe. And if it were a winning recipe, a lot more Democrats would be in office right now than there are. So, you know, the corporate money litmus tests that we're seeing, you know, a lot of Democrats are saying, if I wouldn't vote for Hakeem Jeffries as speaker unless he commits not taking PAC, I'm like, dude, you guys have no idea what you're doing. You could say all you want, it shouldn't be that way. Well, it is. And if your litmus test for leadership is to make sure that the other side, your adversaries, have hundreds of billions of dollars and you have none, good luck.
I love that for Democrats. Keep it up. It's like when the progressives tried to do 32-hour work weeks on Capitol Hill. You guys want to do less? Go. I'm all for it. Good luck. And I mean, this is the perfect segue into what's next, because we got primaries tomorrow in Minnesota and Wisconsin. What do you think happens in both because Wisconsin has the gubernatorial, Minnesota has the gubernatorial and the Senate primary, both of which have socialist underpinnings in all three of those races. Kurt, what do you see here?
Yeah, I mean, I think Francesca, the socialist in Wisconsin, has this thing locked up at this point. I mean, there's just this air of like inevitability that's like in the same way
vibes.
That we saw that. Yeah, like, you know, I don't think that in Minnesota it's as certain as it is with or inevitable as it is with Francesca. I still think those are two really interesting electorates. I just over the years that Minnesotans and Wisconsins are just, they're cut from a different cloth altogether. So Minnesotans, though, like, have obviously shown a penchant for bucking change tradition establishments with the advent of Jesse the Mind Ventura, the OG celebrity,
yes.
Candidate oh winner. So like, yeah, Wisconsin, Minnesota are interesting, but I also think that they've kind of like Maine, they're just kind of on their own island at times and they do what they're going to do. And it's not necessarily a bellwether for the entire country the way that I think Michigan may have been for Democrats. Like, I read less in the Wisconsin to Minnesota than I do Michigan.
Mm. Okay. That's fair. I'm going to say that for Wisconsin, they have always had this underpinning in the state for progressivism. For progressive mm-hmm. ideals. And so Francesca Hong being a socialist who won in Madison, yeah, that makes all the sense in the freaking world. Madison is a progressives hotbed. Nothing like Dane County, Wisconsin to really get you. And the demographics have changed in Wisconsin. It used to be the wow counties outside Milwaukee area where we would mm-hmm. really have to drive up the numbers to win in a general. I still think it's very hard at the top of the ticket to have a socialist in Wisconsin win in November. I still think... And listen, Tom Tiffany today, he has Glenn Youngkin out there campaigning with him. Not the most dynamic Tiffany. But don't get me wrong. I like both of them, but we're not driving massive crowds at rallies with those two. So, you know, I think Tom Tiffany is really trying to play the steady force and the steady hand in that race as the Republican who will probably go against Francesca Hong. And then when you look at Minnesota, there are a couple of interesting things on those races. One, you do have the socialist fight, proxy fight, in a couple mm-hmm. of the races, because lieutenant governor's running, and but also Mike Lindell's running. The
my favorite pillow guy. He's throwing pillows out at crowds and getting sued for it.
I mean, listen, I would be pretty upset if I got smacked in the face with a pillow at a rally for a guy. I gotta tell you, even if it was meant to be fun, don't throw pillows. But that's an interesting one. And Michelle Tafoya in the Senate primary for Republicans there. Michelle Tafoya, the former ESPN.
ESPN, one of the NBC first, Sports.
Mm-hmm, one of the first, I think she was actually one of the first announcers for a WNBA game ever in the history of the league. So she is actually a great, great general election candidate, I think, in Minnesota. Yes. I would definitely keep my eyes on Michelle Tafoya for that race. And I think that when you pair that with the possibility of a socialist who could be linked to Tim Walz, and I think Tim Walz is in a not great state place in Minnesota because of all the fraud stuff, that is going to be the conversation for voters going into November. And if the lieutenant governor wins that primary, you better believe the messaging in Minnesota will be nonstop fraud. It likely will be anyways, but that's an easy direct hit. Minnesota hasn't really flipped in a long time. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I remember the Tim Pawlenty days. I remember the recount days. You know, I remember what Minnesota used to be. It hasn't gone red in a long time, but Michelle Tafoya is a very, I really mean this, a very strong general election candidate. When you couple that with the fraud messaging, she's the Senate race, different than the gubernatorial. I think that state, she might, I think she's my reach of the election right now.
Okay.
If I was going to say, which one do I think is a reach, but possibly gettable? I think I want to give that to Michelle Tafoya. Who's your reach of the election right now? If Democrats were going to make a reach, who's your reach of the election?
Tallarico in Texas.
Okay. All right.
You know, I have been on the Tallarico train from before it was trendy, for the record. You know, as you know,
in Texas, so you get to weigh in
there
more than everybody else by your standards.
That's right, because I see it every day. I see it in my neighborhoods. Like, there's just something there that is what I will say is this: it is more palatable and real than it was when it was Beto. Like, that's what I will say. Like, the measuring stick oftentimes, whether it was Colin Allred or if it's like, can you Beto was the benchmark because he was the closest that they have gotten in a competitive race. And I think that what's happening with Tallarico, I think he is running a far better campaign, honestly. Like, you don't see him on the cover of Vanity Fair or wherever the fuck, right? Like, he's not doing that stupid shit. He is running a very strong, grassroots-oriented campaign. His people are out there. They are doing, like, the door knocking, the signs, the, like just the infrastructure things that sometimes get that Jasmine Crockett didn't do in the primary, for example.
Mitch, isn't she a great surrogate for the Tallarico team?
My God, right? I don't believe the polls that say that he might win. Oh my God, give me a break. So again, I think at the very least, like it is competitive. Paxton could lose. Like it is a losable race, right? Mm-hmm. Is it likely? No, probably not. But if we're talking about what's my reach race, like, Tallarico, Texas. That's mine.
I want to look at this again in a month. Let's see where our reach race is right after Labor Day. Let's keep talking about it, because I think that I think those are two really interesting races to watch. And in all of this primary season noise and parties and all of that, there's the potential of the third party rise now.
Yes.
And we are seeing possibly Tucker Carlson and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massey standing up a third political party in the country. Do you actually think it is plausible in modern United States society to stand up, build, and maintain a full third party operation similar in quality to the RNC and the DNC? And I don't mean that, like, the DNC is a well-run organization. I think Ken Martin's doing a terrible job, so I'm all for that for Democrats. But these behemoths, do you think possible?
No.
Do you think it's even possible? I don't know that it is.
Do I think it's possible for a cycle? Yes. Not this cycle, mind you, but, like, in general, like, if the right person came around, I always use Mark Cuban as an example of this. Someone who has unlimited resources, who could, for one cycle, put together the organization that would be needed to do this for a 2-year stretch? Yes. Would it live on after him? No. Like, and that's the problem that that third parties have in this country, in my opinion, is you might be able to make some noise and gain some legit credibility and be a difference maker, a needle mover for a cycle, for a single race. But what happens after that? That's where it always falls off. Like, whether it was Ross Perot or Ralph Nader or whoever, it's like, you're a flash in the pan, you have your moment, but what comes after you? Nothing. It goes away. Because it's always tied to just a singular figure. The whole point of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party is that it's actually bigger than one figure, than one nominee, than one cycle. Win, lose, or draw. Like, we are created so that we can continue on regardless of what the names are. The independent movement, in the beginning, has to rally around a singular figure. And in the beginning, that figure is actually bigger than its party. And so if that figure does not find immediate success and loses and is dispatched to the island of irrelevancy, there's nothing left to sustain this movement and continue growing it. You're always having to go back to square one every single election cycle to find the right person. And so it would require someone of a level of Michael Bloomberg bequeathing his entire wealth to the independent party of whatever to fund it for a decade. Like, that's what they need.
I think you're right. And I think what it ultimately means for the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the Tucker Carlsons and the Thomas Massey and those who think that they can stand up a third party operation, my guess is they end up standing up a super PAC. My guess is that they don't actually open up an institutional entity that offers people the opportunity to vote for someone else. I will say this. In New York State, you have to run on multiple lines. You can't just run as a Republican and win in the state. Or you can't just even run as a Democrat. You have to run on the Democrat line, the working families line, the green line. There's a number of lines you have to run on as a Republican. You run Republican, conservative, independents, right? You have to carry multiple lines. I actually think that model is better nationwide, and dare I say, you know, nice things about the New York voting systems, but in terms of primary processes and in terms of making sure there is a diversity of voices supporting a certain candidate, I see that model is working. And if you go back historically, let's go back to 2010, Jimmy McMillan, the rent is too damn high party, was a party. He was a third party candidate running to try and get the Democrat line as well. And, you know, the independents line, if they can get it, and the working families. But Rent Is Too Damn High was an actual party on the ballot.
Yep.
Now, again, most of the time, these third parties are just spoilers. But I think given the, to your point, the time, the intensity, the length that it takes to build a national infrastructure as a party and not for a person is very difficult to do. And I don't think that as Tucker Carlson is building his empire, media, books, everything else, that or Marjorie Taylor Greene, that they want to spend their full time trying to become the chair of a new party to build, because you have to have somebody who's like a political operator and strategist to start that kind of party. You would need someone like a Donna Brazile. Right. Somebody who's done races and knows this stuff. And they're not doing that. And they're not thinking that. So right now, they're just going to play spoiler and super PAC in my mind. I don't see them actually be able to get there. And I could be wrong. Like,
If this were for real, though, they would also have counterparts of equal notoriety joining with them. Like they just
the Republicans who don't want to be Republican anymore because they're beefing with Trump.
Yes. Sure. It's like you just have beefing with Trump Republicans. And
that's the name of the party.
The
beefing with Trump. Although that could get a bipartisan. That could be a bipartisan party. The beefing with Trump party.
That would make it bigger. It's like you take Never Trump Republicans and combine it with the Never Trump MAGA people. But it's like, it's not like there's a prominent Democrat that is equally disaffected with the Democratic Party that is also partnering with. My God.
He's not going to partner with them, but I do think he's at level of disaffected with.
Oh, he's at that level. But that's what it would take, though, for this to like have some sea legs organizationally. It's like, okay, have the former vice chair of the DNC standing with former MAGA Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, former Thomas Massey, who just ran as Republican, lost in Republican primary, and former Fox News centerpiece Tucker Carlson. It's like, you got to have the other side there for this to actually be a true third. This isn't a third party. This is Republicans who have run afoul of Donald Trump or vice versa, and they're pissed about it. It's like, you didn't break up with me, I'm breaking up with you, and now I'm going to go like date other people. It's like, okay.
Don't threaten me with a good time. There's a reason this didn't work.
right. So I just until you have the counterbalance of that on the Democrat side joining you, this isn't a third party. It's just it's just people who are pissed off at the Republican Party, but they're still Republicans. Like, they're not voting for fucking, any Democrat that you've ever heard of. They're not propping up and getting behind and campaigning for, any person.
They're not MAGA,
campaigning for James Tallarico in Texas. Come on.
You know, they're saying that their line is like those who are going to put it's America first, right? Like, okay, well, Marjorie Taylor Greene said today in the paper that there's a bunch of donors who want to line up. Okay, if you guys are an America first, if you want to call yourself the America First Party, fine. Put money in now. If you've got donors who are ready to cut checks, put money in now and start operating that way. But they have to actually set up an institution.
You show up, have a press conference, say, hey, we are launching the X and we have $100 million in the bank and we have hired so-and-so as our exec. Like, okay, that's real. I'll take that with credibility. But you didn't. All basically that you did is tell me that you're going to basically have some semblance of a podcast and a Substack newsletter bitching about the Republican Party. That's my takeaway.
It's the Festivus days of political parties. I got grievances with everyone and you're all going to hear it.
And they'll make a shit ton of money doing this. Like, they will grift their way to relevance and fortune, as this somewhat become the American way anyway. So like, whatever. But as a political force, I don't know a single voter, and nor do you, that's going to sit there, get their little ballot and go, you know what? I want to know what Tucker Carlson and Marjorie Taylor Greene think about this race before I vote. I don't know that. I don't know who that constituency is.
Yeah, or the one that has them as their thought leader, but also finds a way to be a different independent party, right? Like, if you're thinking like, I'm listening to Marjorie Taylor Greene and Tucker Carlson, then the idea that there would be, I mean, I would love to see like somebody on the left, to your point, that matches that. You know, I just don't see that for them anywhere.
I don't see it.
Third party, they're gonna try to make Fetch happen, aren't they? They really are.
They are. We're gonna try to make Jeb happen.
Exclamation point.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
All right. That's it.
That's it.
That's all the fun we're gonna have today.
Oh man, listen, I'm going to say one last thing then before we go.
Yeah.
Because we've been talking about third parties, been talking about people disaffected with third parties. I thought that on Morning Joe Scarborough went on a vintage Joe Scarborough monologue demanding that Democrats disavow Hassan Piker and distance themselves from him. And to that I say bravo. Bravo, Joe. I couldn't agree more. Having someone who has said, you know, what he has said about 9/11, just that alone, forget about everything else. Let's just isolate that one thing. That is, in my opinion, as an American, disqualifying for you to be at any proximity to anyone that would hold public office. Nevertheless, yeah, him, but like disqualifying. So I applaud, you know, we often talk about frustrations we have with people failing to police their own party at times. And watching Joe on the flagship, you know, like say like, hey, what the hell are we doing here? This guy's on stage introducing, you know, like our would-be Senate nominee. That's too far. That's not okay. Like back away from Piker. Like I couldn't agree more.
So I'm going to do a little put up or shut up here for Democrats then. If the stance is, and there are people in the party calling out to say, man, no Hassan Piker, then the backup to that needs to be, I think, then we're going to work against you, El Sayed, because if you're going to stand with someone like that, we're going to make sure you don't get elected, right? That's where the line is. You can say, don't hang out with Hassan Piker all you want, but unless you're willing to actually stand up to the people who do that and who associate with them, even when you know it's bad for the party and bad for the country, that's the put up or shut up moment there for Democrats. You either keep letting the talking heads be the voices in the room that say, don't do it, or you actively start working against the people who continue to cozy up with people like Hassan Piker, who do believe that America deserved 9/11. And I agree with you wholeheartedly, Kurt. That is immediately disqualifying. I do not care. We grew up in the 9/11 generation. I was in eighth grade when 9/11 happened. I remember it vividly. That for me is a bridge too far. And I don't care what race you're running. If that is the person that is supporting you, they should be, then the party apparatus should work against you. And I know it's bloodlust. I've been talking bloodlust all show. I've been talking bloodlust and victory all show. But you don't get to even compare the moral authority on it for, you know, Joe to say, no, he either does it or we don't help him. Like it's the old John Boehner of like, you can do it, but nobody's going to have your back if you do it. Like that's where it needs to go.
I feel that way about people like Piker. I feel that way about like people like, you know, Nick Fuentes, honestly.
Oh, 100%.
You know,
100%.
And so I would gladly take personally, like I would rather have Senator Mike Rogers, who is, when it comes to foreign policy and intel specifically, like as good as you're going to get in the United States, regardless of political party. I would take Senator Mike Rogers over someone who is okay sharing a stage with Hassan Piker, and not like at the very least strongly disavowing and say like, this shit's like, you know, I appreciate your support, but you're wrong on this. It's like, you know, you got to say the words out loud and mean it, rather than just stand next to the guy and let him be your opening act. Like that is disqualifying to me.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you. Got to say it with your chest and with your money. Democrats need to put the pressure on to just, Hassan Piker should not be doing political events the way I think that, to your point, Nick Fuentes shouldn't. Woo, let's hold some people accountable.
That's right. We are on the same page. Look at that.
Look at us. It happens.
Every now and again. Well, this was cool. All right, we're going to have a interesting week here. We have some primaries, like I said. The South Carolina primary for Graham's seat will be the next chapter of that. If someone doesn't get 50+1, they go to a runoff, which is what I think will probably happen, actually. So we'll see if Darlene Graham can pull it off. But we will be back on Thursday with more primary madness, I'm sure.
I know. Rate, review, subscribe. We're a lot of fun.
We are a lot of fun. All right, party animals. We'll see you next time.
Party on.
Bye.
Bye.